Hello and welcome to Reclaiming My Theology, a podcast seeking to take our theology back from ideas and systems that oppress. I'm your host, Brandy Miller, and first of all, I just want to say thank you so much for all of your support of our Advent devotional, the book, all the resources. It's been so amazing to see not only the ways in which it's reaching and touching people, but the ways that you all are using it, seeing the ways that you all spent time in play this week, that you're engaging with the devotional resources themselves, that you're reflecting and finding God somehow in this chaos that is 2020. Y'all, it's such a gift. So we're launching now our four-week series on Advent on the podcast itself. Today I'm talking to two of my friends who are currently pregnant because I don't feel like there are better people to hear from than folks who are actually pregnant when we're talking about a story of a pregnancy. I do want to name in these conversations that there are limitations to how Christians often talk about pregnancy, and so I just want to name the reality that all kinds of people give birth. Women give birth, men give birth, people who identify outside of the gender binary give birth, single people give birth, people in forms of partnerships other than traditional monogamous marriage give birth. Our conversations don't necessarily reflect this reality, but I think it's really important to say anyway. And also, this is a special episode because you don't get one, but two conversations, so enjoy the start with my friend Ollie. I appreciate you taking a moment to chat with me.
Oh, for sure. For sure, for sure.
Yeah, because I haven't seen you in a minute, and you've been growing a child since then, so.
A lot of things have happened in our whole world. I don't miss a lot of things about where, like, I could be pretty happy never going back to work ever, you know. But obviously, if we could get paid to, like, do the other work that I'm doing, which I'm also doing full time.
Yes, of course. But I would love for people to get to know you a little bit, because you're a person I deeply respect and care about. And so, yeah, Ale, what does it mean to be you?
Yeah, I feel like what it means to be me. I mean, I think for me, it's like very rooted in who's the like family that I come from and the people that I come from. My family on my mom's side immigrated to the U.S. Maybe around 50 years ago, or started coming. They were the first wave, and so both very rooted in being Mexicanos, but also I've lived in the U.S. for a long time, so kind of in a borderland in many different ways in terms of their identity. And each generation, it changes a little bit. And I feel like all of those kind of inform who we are. So the older generations that are very deeply connected to being Mexicano and being, I think, some of the indigenous story of our family, they experience that more, even though they wouldn't call it that. Just so their connection to food and to their land and just what it means to, care for the land and have different, they wouldn't call them ceremonies, or they wouldn't call them like medicines, but to use that kind of language that's a little more familiar to us now. And so, like, all those generations shaped me. My abuela wouldn't say this, but we'll call her a curandera or a healer. And my mom does. She was the first in our family to graduate, go to school, go to college, get her PhD. I mean, like, she went for it. She's like, hey, I'm gonna, like, learn English as a second language and just go, like, all the way. So
it's amazing.
So I feel like particularly the women in that story have shaped a lot of who I am. When I think of, like, what does it mean to be me, I think of standing in kind of their shoes, their kind of their legacy. And then I also am somebody who's making my own family. So I'm married to Sam, married to this white guy who grew up as a TCK. That's a whole nother story. What it means to figure out our life and family together. And then I have my son Emmanuel, and then our other little one on the way, who's going to be here in anywhere from hopefully at least five more weeks, but could come, you know, earlier. And so I think being there, mama, has shaped a lot of who I am now and kind of how I think of who I am now. So I'm Mexicana, Americana. Part of that means that coming from an indigenous community, and also European communities and the complexity of all of that. Mm. I'm also Italian American on my dad's side. And there's less that we know about there. There's a lot more kind of broken complicatedness on that side. Mm. But still shapes a lot of things. So
yes.
Yeah. So all those kind of pieces messily and beautifully. Some days it feels more messy. Some days it's more like, oh, I see this.
That's so good.
Together.
Well, you mentioned how pregnant you are right now. You are carrying a child during the Advent season of the year of, I'm not even going to call it the year of our Lord because that feels disrespectful, 2020.
Yeah. 2020. Yes, it's been kind of surreal to, because I feel like particularly just like, it's just weird timing to kind of like match up a little bit with our Christmas, even though, you know, the dates are all, that's a whole nother story. But yeah, thinking about being very pregnant as Christmas is coming, and I've just had some space to think a little bit about like Maria's story. We read a lot of like just read books with Emmanuel, try to read books from like different stories, different traditions, different communities with him. And so he's very into reading about Maria and Jose and their posada, their like journey, looking for shelter and trying to kind of help him understand or just talk about that together. Cause yeah, we're still learning many pieces about that as well. So it's been strange to kind of match up a little bit with that. I feel like, I think there've been many different thoughts that have come to mind. So my first pregnancy, I saw a doctor in a hospital. This pregnancy, I actually have some really great midwives. They're the only Black-owned birthing center in LA, and they're phenomenal. Been midwifing for the community for many, many years, and it's just been unique to think about the legacy of like people who accompany people in birth. And so I think one of the things that I've thought about recently was like who accompanied Mary in her birth. Like, what is that? What does that mean to be accompanied, and what did that mean for her? And you know, there's like this story that we kind of hear about, like, well, there's no room in the inn, like there's no, you know, there's many different pieces of that narrative that we hear. And I think I've just been wondering about that, because I'm like, well, like, there's no way that they could have been alone, because either like Mary didn't have anybody to like help her birth this baby, or Joseph was the one who like helped her birth this baby. And it's not like Joseph's gonna have any like training in like being a partero. Like, he's not a midwife or husband. I guess you're so called, there are some male midwives. So and so I've just been thinking about that, and like, what is that, you know, how does that change kind of that story to think about like, oh, there is actually still probably a community of at least one, probably more women with Mary and with Joseph as they're getting ready to, as they're having this child, as they're going through labors, they're preparing for things. And there's this huge legacy of that in Jewish communities, this like very resistant, powerful legacy of women that's very unseen. We see that in the story of Moses. And so I think that's been just unique to like sit with my midwives and think about like their legacy in Black communities, and like Latinx, Latina, Indigenous midwives in other communities who kind of in for many years kind of done that just on their own, kind of underground a little bit, or just not well known, not well acknowledged, but yet have this like just vital role in bringing life, accompanying life into the world. And so I think that's been really fun to to think about, like, oh, Mary had midwives, most likely. Mary had people who taught her how to breastfeed. Like, Mary had people who, like, taught her how to do all these, like, very messy things of motherhood. And, you know, it wasn't just this, like, solitary by herself. that would be very, very difficult. So I think I found a lot of, like, comfort in you know, I think in like more Mexican traditions, there's more Protestants are probably more uncomfortable with the idea of Mary and talking about Guadalupe and some of those. But I feel like there's a lot of like, you know, Mexican Catholic and liberation theology that's very deeply centered around the story of Mary and Guadalupe as a very liberated figure. And so it's been really fun to connect with her in this season as this like liberator who's in like life bringing in life and creating life. And so yeah, that's been a unique kind of connection to kind of feel accompanied by her, if that makes sense, in the midst of COVID when there's not a lot of like folks around or people around. Like there's just, it's very difficult to have other kinds of community. Everybody's trying how they can, but it's a whole different thing. And so I think have been leaning into kind of those stories and those legacies in Mary and in other other stories in scripture, other stories of Las Santas. So that's been helpful in this season.
That's so good. I love that idea of Mary as the one who accompanies, who isn't just the one who is accompanied, but who in her both carrying and being accompanied by Jesus himself, being accompanied by others, now accompanies women and folks who give birth to, now. Like, it feels really significant that Mary would follow people as a liberator, that the liberator, like the great liberator, comes from. There's something too that feels really striking to me in this moment.
Yeah, I like when I think of like her, you know, I think there's a photo, it's been circulating a little bit more recently, somebody took part of the Magnificat, which is Mary's song that she says after she finds out she's going to be pregnant. They made it into more of like a picture that's been circulating on social media about like with it's Mary with the Guadalupe. I call it the Guadalupe, so like anytime you see a Mary with the turquoise that has the stars, that's not just Mary, that's like Guadalupe Mary, that's like Mexican, like, it's like indigenous Mary. you know, so like the, you know, it's that quote of it's to cast down the mighty and send the rich away empty. So I think there's just something about her story that's so powerful in this season. And just even thinking about like who, but that was always who she is, who she was, not just this like, yo no sé nada, like I don't know anything teenager, but like somebody who has deep theology.
Yes.
Like crazy, just deeply embodies like the God, like all of the shalom of God and how she sees how the world should be. And then continues to like lead people in that. So
good.
Yeah, all my Catholic friends, well, many of my Catholic friends, they got some good stuff on engaging with what it means to engage with Mary. So I have a lot to learn.
It's so good. Well, talk to me a little bit about your Advent this season, and you're being accompanied by Mary, by Maria in this season. What else is coming to mind for you? What's coming up? What feels significant? What feels new or renewed for you in this time?
That's a great question. I feel like in some of the things that we used to do around Advent, that's been a lot trickier this year, just trying to kind of like figure out what does Advent look like without posadas. Like there's so many traditions that we have that are disrupted because of the pandemic, so many that are like so deeply community based. So it's actually been very interesting to try to figure out, like, normally we have like all these traditions and all these things that we do. And I feel like I'm still kind of trying to find my way a little bit of like how do you even have Advent as like a small family separated from community? Or it feels more separated from community. So in past years, we participate in posadas, which is like a tradition of following the following Mary and Joseph to, I don't know if you're familiar with the posadas, but like briefly explain it, but like following them, you go to different homes, mm-hmm. And ask, there's a song that you sing and you're asking for posada, which is shelter, yeah. For a place to stay. And everyone, you know, the first one say no. And there's like a call and response that you do. And then at the last one, they welcome you. And everyone has a party and it's very communal, but often we do those at the border, because we're thinking about the journey that our refugee and asylum seeking brothers and sisters are taking, that is in the footsteps of the Holy Family. And, you know, there's more who are coming now. So to be honest, it's felt very complicated to think about what does that look like away from those communities? Like, yeah. Even more so needing to really distance myself from people in this season as cases are rising and kind of having to remember like, oh, like I'm in a high risk category now and I need to take care of this life. And even as there's others, like this is an important life for me to take care of so that our generations are able to take care of others.
Wow.
Yeah, so I feel like it feels very messy in many ways. So I think even just like today, I'm just like, how do I connect with those old traditions? So I was trying to make atole, which is like a drink that we have or champurrado, which is a kind of atole. It's a drink that we have around Christmas time and made from corn or you can make it out of different things, but usually corn, like a natural cane sugar, and cinnamon, and you could add chocolate to it. interestingly, it's actually like you drink it for lactation too. Like, so you drink it when you're breastfeeding.
Oh, wow.
Like helps. Yeah. So it's like actually like a drink that has like had many thousands of years of like medicinal properties, but we drink it at Christmas. So... Which is interesting. I'm like just like processing to it. Like, oh, very interesting that we're like all drinking this thing that's like this medicine for recent birthing people, recently birthed people. So we're trying to make that. I'm gonna go try to make that and just see how I'm able to connect to things.
Yeah.
So I think just trying to kind of be present to my own body and. Yeah, has been like kind of what it looked like, I guess. Like,
yeah,
you know, we talk a lot about preparation or waiting at Advent, and I feel like it's not something that's happening outside of myself this year. It's like something that's happening inside of me too. So I think the work is like paying attention to what's happening in me as like part of the what it means to even like celebrate Advent. Can I like celebrate myself? I celebrate my own body? Can I celebrate its own power and connection to other women who have done that? And so it feels like a very non-traditional Advent in a number of ways.
Of course, yes. Yeah, that seems about right. Wow. Well, that's really wild and it's so, such a peculiar context to be doing all of this in, with the isolation and the timing and having a beautiful 3-year-old who's, I'm sure, full of all of the energy he's always full of. Yeah, I just feel like I have a strong sense of like your resilience and the miracle that it is that you're growing another human in you, and the generational significance of that is quite profound in a lot of ways, and I know you know that. I just love to hear you share that story, and I feel honored that you would even share what some of your traditions are and what you do and how those are intersecting with your life right now, because that's huge.
It's fun to get to like think about together with people. Yeah, it really is quite pretty miraculous. I feel like I feel like I'm like externally processing things as we're talking, you know, but I think what you talked about makes me think of how like, oh, like, you know, for Mary, people talk about like, oh, miracle. So I'm like, oh, pues, like, and I think like Sojourner Truth talks about this a lot in her like, in a woman's speech about like like there was the Lord and like her and Mary, like there was no, like there was just them, and there's this beautiful miracle that's being created so intimately between God, between creator and like women, you know. And this woman, and that's a beautiful thing to have, that like power uniquely for women. There's this like deep power that's there, like only, it's only between women that life is created. And so there's just this connection there that's, yeah, beautiful. So feel like there's a connection to like many different aspects of the character of God. That feels, just cool to think about how like in places where like women birth, you know, and birthing is often just such a like something that's just so shamed in our culture, and hidden in many ways, all aspects of it, or many aspects of it, but to think about how like God uniquely uses women as birthers in creating life, and the power that's like very uniquely placed in those bodies, or the potential for that. And obviously it doesn't have to only happen through like physically giving birth, but there's still a potential. There's a power of birthing new things, whether it's people or other things, that I feel like uniquely like women femmes carry, in that like spirit, that feminine spirit of power. I don't know. I just think about that at this time.
That totally makes sense. Well, I don't want to take too much of your time, but this is the first week of Advent, and hope is generally the theme that people pull from this first week. How are you thinking about, or are you thinking about hope right now? What does that look like for you in this very unique season in your life?
That's a very good question. What does hope look like right now? I think like hope has felt very hard in a number of ways for a while. I feel like I'm somebody who's very like emotionally driven, and so I think it has felt hard to feel hope in a tangible way when I look at like many of the like external circumstances that are happening in our world. I think particularly recently thinking about this like newest caravan of refugiados, like asylum seekers who have been at the border, on the border, are coming, and more and more coming. And 2-3 years ago, there was all of this, not all of this. These people were able to be a present, you know, and now that's really changed people's capacity to be a part of things, and even the situation that they're coming into is just even that much more hopeless. So I think when I think of those kinds of big stories, it has felt very hard to feel a sense of hope. But at the same time, I think this year, I think hope has meant more of like, leaning into like stories and things that like that different traditions tell us are true, and just kind of being like, well, you say this is gonna happen, so I'm just gonna like believe you, don't mess up, don't get it wrong, but just kind of it feels a little crazy to feel like talking about hope. Like I was trying to talk to Emmanuel about like the first candle of Advent and Esperanza, and what does that even mean, and I didn't really have words for it, and I feel like that's been true for myself too. I feel like I'm needing to learn more of what does hope look like when you don't like feel something emotionally. I think places where I feel where I do feel hopeful have more to do with the stories of people who are continuing to be resilient and continuing to take movements. I think particularly like being very absent from so many of the spaces that I'm usually in this season also, I think can make that challenging to feel like, oh, like I'm not a part of moving anything forward right now. That's outside of just moving this, meaning like gesturing to my belly, like moving this forward. There's gonna be a lot of forward movement there in not that many weeks, but outside of that, no. And so I think do I feel hopeful when I'm not a part of something, when I'm just trusting other people's stories or their participation, their actions? Is that enough? Is that enough to give me hope for something? And so that's been a question that I'm holding. And even just like, can making space for my own body, my own birthing process, bringing in this new life, cannot be something that I can trust as like hopeful, that is like something good happens here, something happens here, that's enough of hope for things. So I think that's some of what I'm sitting with. Again, I think it just feels messy, but I feel like birth is messy. Probably one of the messiest things that we do. Very, very messy in many ways. And yet there's this like powerful life that comes. And on the other side, like there's a life that's there. And so I think there's something that like, you know, in birthing, there's whatever kind of birth process you have, there's going to be a lot of pain involved into it, but it's not a like purposeless pain. It's very purposeful. Part of what's creating things. So I guess that's something that's like, I don't feel hopeful yet, but I'm trusting is like, and there will be life on the other side of that. And so I think even when I don't feel hopeful, when it feels more painful, I guess I'm trusting that there's something that's being worked, created, even in the midst of that being painful, that brings life in another.
So good. That sounds a lot like hoping for hope.
Yeah, that's a really succinct way to put that. That's great.
That's so good. I so appreciate you and your time, and I know you're probably wanting to sleep soonish because you're doing hard work in your body, and that is so good. But thank you so much for talking to me, for bringing the uniqueness of your life to listeners. It's really a gift. So.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Right. Y'all, isn't Ollie dope? I am for sure trying to get her back for our 2.0 run at Reclaiming My Theology from White Supremacy, because she is just so freaking good. And I know that's really obvious to you now that you've heard her, but we have more. I think that it's really important that we hear from lots of different perspectives around birth, around Advent, around our faith and theology and Christianity, if that's what you go for in general. And so we're going to hear now from my friend Kylie, who is earlier on in her pregnancy and who shares with us a lot about her background and what it means to hope in this season and the ways in which we engage with hope and darkness and the complexity of it all. So please enjoy this conversation with Kylie. Thank you, Kylie, so much for being on the podcast today.
Yeah, I'm so excited.
Well, Kylie, I realize we know each other from, I don't know, I've known you since you were like really, really like a very small person. but for folks who haven't known you, how would you describe what it means to you?
Yes. Oh, my goodness. This question, though. So number one is being rooted in a Christian upbringing. So family life. And then as well as church. And we met at church. So I started, went to a Church of God church and then Baptist and then a non-denom church, which is its own denomination, but a small rural church. And then, higher education, doing 2 years of Bible school right outside of high school, did that. And then that wasn't enough. So I went to Wheaton College and did that. So yeah, very much so like deep entrenched in a Christian upbringing. And then an important element to mention is realizing my own sexuality and then coming out during my college experience. And that just shifted things and made me start to ponder things differently, think through things differently. Just in case there's anyone who's listening to this, a super helpful book was Bible, Gender, and Sexuality by Brownson. And for me, something that I kept coming back to in my coming out experience and figuring how that worked, reconciling that with my faith, was this whole concept of a good tree bearing good fruit from like Matthew 7. And just thinking about, and if, as it relates to theology, theology is either life-giving or life-taking, and you will see the results of it. So literally, like, a good tree cannot bear bad fruit, and a bad tree cannot bear good fruit. So that was helpful for me in thinking about my own sexuality. So an important part for me of growing up is just my own whiteness, which obviously has a huge impact, and also something that I did not come to terms with because I didn't have to until college. And really for me, an area where I was able to grow in that awareness was during my junior year of college. So I was in like it was called a Shalom community. And it was focused on racial reconciliation, which might be kind of a trigger word for people because that like implies some sort of equal footing. Yeah, it was just a really good experience to live in community with people who are different than me. I'm extremely grateful, you know, to those friends who have and still are patiently granting me the space to be able to grow in awareness and allyship, and particularly at their own expense, because it's very exhausting to continually discuss an aspect of yourself and an important part of yourself, and nobody has to do that. So it's very gracious that people are still willing to even have conversations about that. The other thing I was going to say is I am an embodied person because I have this human body. No, something that I've learned lately is that I carry both joy and grief in my body. And so, you know, as an example, like as people who I love and who I cherish become further entrenched in non-affirming theology, well, I feel that in my body. As much as you don't want to, and as much as you want to compartmentalize it. Yeah, you just feel things in your body, and also joy as well, but also embodied because I'm pregnant, which is very relevant to Advent. So, so my wife Rachel and I are expecting our first baby on April Fool's Day. So that's fun. It's a big old joke. But yeah, it's been really interesting to think of the Christmas story differently, and just to think about literally like Jesus being a tiny, tiny human in another human's womb is kind of crazy. So that's a lot about me.
I love that. And thank you so much for sharing. Congrats on the baby. That's so exciting. And also probably kind of bonkers in like 2020 in all of these kinds of ways. And I've watched you for a long time figuring out what it means to engage with your own sexuality and what that means for your community, what that meant for you getting married, and now being pregnant with a child. It just feels like there's so many things that I imagine were not the evangelical dream for your life.
And so how I'm just do you really mean?
So, if you didn't know. But it does feel like there's these ways, the ways in which you embody marginalization and privilege together, and you hold those things. I really just appreciate that. And I just feel like at the end of the day, especially as you're in the season of being a pregnant queer person figuring out how to exist in the world, the Advent probably does hit a little bit different, like you're saying. And I really wanted to make sure that we were hearing from women for all of Advent, folks of marginalized identities, and folks who are pregnant or have had children, because white men talking about what it means to have babies is frankly kind of exhausting. yeah, as we are launching our series on Advent, we have a devotional book out that has all kinds of stuff in it around embodying, like you're talking about, being an embodied person who is trying to figure out what it means to do Advent, to celebrate this Christmas and Advent season. And so I'm curious for you, before we jump into what Advent means for you right now, because I think there's probably some rich depth in what that means for your life. But when you were taught the Christmas story, the story of Jesus's birth, what it means to do Advent, what was emphasized for you? And what do you feel like has been kind of missed as you are grappling with what it means for you in this season?
Yeah, this is a fun question to kind of ponder, because I was just going back to childhood and all of those nativity like scenes that you reenact, and are you going to be Mary or not? You don't know. I think what was really emphasized, or one of the aspects, was just Jesus's humble beginning, because you see the whole thing reenacted and he's not born to some earthly ruler, but a very, very young woman, we would call a girl, a teenage girl, who traditionally would have been looked down on in that society, and, you know, still today. But then the fact that there like literally was not even room in the inn. And when I think about the Christmas story growing up, I think about all of the kids who got to play animals in the plays, and just like that Jesus was literally just among these animals and then being born like swaddled in cloth and then put in a manger. And I didn't really understand what a manger was, but like it is just a feeding trough. The animals just eat out of there, and that Jesus was put in there. So that was emphasized. And something that maybe wasn't intentionally emphasized was kind of this idea of like this wondrous, magical element of like the star. I was reading about that recently, trying to like remember, you know, the whole story. And the Magi are there, and then they see the star, and then it says like they had seen the star in the east, and then it went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. And then the Magi in general were always the best dressed, like very shiny stuff. But they just seemed really wonderful. There was just this sense of awe. So it's like this humble beginning, but then also this really fascinating sense of awe and wonder in the whole story. But you also asked what was missed.
Yes.
When I think about the story, I was told we never really hit on King Herod that much and his like evil plot to trick the Magi and be like, yeah, I totally want to worship this Jesus kid too. So if you just let me know where he is, I will follow you and then I will worship him. But he just wants to kill him because Jesus is a threat to his position of power. And Herod just thought that there was going to be another earthly king, another earthly ruler that would somehow be more powerful than him. But it wasn't like Jesus, he wasn't even within his frame of imagination or reference. It was just so different than he thought. Also, this is emphasized with Advent. And I will say, I really wasn't growing up, Advent itself wasn't super emphasized. It wasn't until college that I went to what some people would refer to as like more high church mm-hmm. versus low church. There was a better observance of the like Christian calendar. That was something that I really started to learn about more as I was older, which honestly made it hit with me differently than it would have if I had just grown up with it. But Advent emphasizes this waiting, but I don't think it totally emphasizes it enough, because I just think about Mary and how she had this interaction with an angel who told her, you're going to be pregnant. You are a virgin. I realize that, Mary, but you're going to be pregnant and you're going to stay a virgin till you have this baby. And Mary was like, okay. So, because I'm thinking of my own experience, like being pregnant and like taking a kajillion pregnancy tests and being like, I think that this is real. And then months into it being like, is there something in there? Like, I don't know. Like, I'm just getting a little bit fatter and I don't know. And it was not until an ultrasound that I really understood, like, there is a human inside of me. To be someone who, for Mary, literally did not have sex and then is just trusting that she's going to have a baby, and that this baby is going to be the hope of the world, will be called, you know, the Son of God. Like, that's a lot of waiting. But then she has the baby, and she's been hopeful for that event. But then she has to wait this whole time to see it all revealed. Yeah. It's not just like this short, like we get these like little snippets, but I just wonder what it was like to be her, to like, as it says, like pondering those things in her heart. Like, that feels like that would have been a big moment, a big season for her, and not just this moment of like, I wonder what all this means. Yeah. So a lot of waiting, which I think is relevant to 2020, because it just feels like a big old year of waiting and hoping that things will be slightly better one day.
Totally. Well, there's so much in there with what you're saying about your own experience of the Christmas season, even, and just kind of this, we don't think about the humanity of the story very much. It's either like this humble moment that we then just move past really quickly of Jesus being in like a feeding trough, or it's this like majestic, magical. I think I've heard a lot of Christmas sermons that start out with John 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. And there was, you know, yeah, and it's like, and the light has come, and the darkness can't overcome it. And it's like so abstract and magical that you can't do the real work that's happening in the story, which is like this political thing that you're talking about with Herod, where Herod is, much like leaders of our day, a political figure who is out to do whatever he can to stay in power, regardless of the morals and the ethics of that situation. And so I think there's these ways that there's an entire community of people, of God's people, who are waiting for God to come back and to show up. And there's this political power that's making it, that is doing all kinds of, what I'm going to call nefarious things. And when God decides to show up in a way that is unexpected, as a freaking baby, this political force is seeking to push back what we would call later theologically in some spaces the kingdom of God, like what would push back on that over and over again, that you have generations of Herods who actually attempt to keep this like good news, this peace bringing, this setting us on the right path, the good way. I am aware this year that the story being sanitized in that way makes us devalue Mary and her own humanity, as well as Jesus and his humanity, because I think that sometimes we like lamb imagery, because scripture does too, but it's like Jesus is born and then we like fatten him up to be the sacrificial lamb and then we kill him off. And it's like, that's not what's happening in this early story. It is like this gritty human experience. And one of the things that I've been considering as I've been reflecting on it this year is how freaking exhausting the story is. Because Mary has this, like you're talking about, kind of inevitably bizarre and socially contentious event with this angel. It makes her a person who's already on the outskirts of society even more and more marginalized. And like you're saying, she doesn't have science. Like, she doesn't have science in the same way that we do. She doesn't know that she's pregnant. She's just like, yeah, okay. And it could be months before she knows that the thing is happening. I just wonder what the exhaustion of going, hey, I heard this thing and I think I'm gonna have a baby, and they're like, bro, what? When she realizes this, she goes straight to go visit her cousin Elizabeth, who lives presumably like 70 miles away. So it's like you finding out you're pregnant and then walking 70 miles, or like being on a donkey 70 miles away from where you are now. And then after a few months, she goes back the 70 miles. And then they have to go to the census tax when she's about to pop.
Right.
And have to walk another 90-ish miles. Most of which we know, right, it's not modern time, so it's unpaved, it's mostly uphill for their journey there. And she's doing that at 9 months pregnant. And so as I think about the waiting, I think about the exhaustion of waiting and how hard it must be to hope in that kind of situation. Because this first week of Advent, right, is about hope, and we'll talk about that more in a minute. But I am just aware that exhaustion makes hope really, really hard. And so I think I have this extra respect for Mary this year as I consider the exhaustion that she must have been experiencing in the walking and in the waiting that she then lives out for the rest of her life, as she doesn't know what's going on fully, like you're saying, which is wild.
Yes, it is wild. Yeah, all of that exercise she was doing while really pregnant. That is, man, I was telling Rachel last night, I was like, I know a lot of women will say like, I feel so alive. I felt the most alive when I was pregnant. I was like, I feel like I'm dying sometimes. Yes. It is not the most lovely experience at times. And things happen that no one tells you about. Did you know that your feet can grow when you're pregnant? No. I had no idea. I learned this last night. Your feet literally can grow. And then there's foot pain. What is that?
Yeah. Yes.
Who does that? Anyway, the fact that she was going through all of these physiological changes and then just doing her thing back in the day, walking around many, many miles, sitting on donkeys, which can't be comfortable, and was just so pregnant is wild.
Yeah, I just feel like Advent for you probably has really different implications right now than it does, than it has before. So can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Being pregnant puts it in a different light. Thinking about Jesus truly as a baby, because we see that imagery again and again. I feel like there's this huge lack of context in the story for how baby Jesus grew into adult Jesus. Like, there's this super heavy emphasis on the birth story and then almost an immediate jump to a 30-year-old man. And it's confusing. And as I'm thinking about what our baby is going to be like and what their personality will be like and who they will grow to become. And then I think of that in light of Advent and of Jesus's birth. I just really wish we knew more about Jesus as a child. Mm-hmm. How he played, the wonder that he saw in the world. And I just want to know more about Jesus as a child and Mary herself as a mother and what that looked like, which is a whole other thing about, you know, when you're the mother of the Son of God, like what does mothering look like? Yes. What does parenting look like? But it's really interesting to think about, what Jesus would have been like as a child and as a teenager and all of that, and how he would have grappled with his own experience and like his own body, mm-hmm. and the changes that he went through. Jesus being associated from the beginning, not with the rulers of the earth, but with the lowly, being put in a feeding trough, being prophesied to be this great ruler, but in a way that was totally different than we could understand.
Yes.
Or that we do understand now.
Yeah, because there is this way that there is a temptation as we read the Christmas story, for those of us especially who come from evangelical backgrounds, to just see Jesus as like popping out like a baby, but still like, it's like we do the like fully God and fully human as though both don't have to like develop in some way in a baby. Like as though Jesus just came out like fully aware of who he was and was just like a beaming 3-year-old who was just like, yeah, I'm the Son of the living God. It just doesn't seem like that's the case. It seems like in being human, in embracing his humanity, that Jesus goes through puberty, that Jesus has to grapple with vocation and with identity and with relationships and with family and figure out like, what does that mean to individuate? And I think when we make the story of Christmas this like old, when we do Christmas and Easter as these like ultimate things, we miss the kind of mundane middle that most of us live most of our lives in. And to me, that feels like, I don't know, a tragedy of some sort, because it forces us in some ways to make our lives about ethereal concepts later rather than like the thing that God is forming in us right now. And so I want to talk a little bit about hope, because this is the first week of Advent. We're talking about hope. It's traditionally the first week of Advent, and I want us to talk about it, define it, and talk about its limitations a little bit, because when I was growing up in the church, insofar as I did, hope was not contrasted to hopelessness. Hope was contrasted to darkness. Like, there's a hope in you that helps you to overcome, like, sin and temptation, and it was more about being hopeful that God could love you enough to take away your sins so that the sucky version of you that God doesn't like can be replaced by just like a little copycat of Jesus. And so hope was actually more about avoiding punishment or judgment in kind of my experience than it was about, there are things in your life that you don't think are possible. Like, there are things that you don't believe that God loves about you, or that God could redeem or restore or do something in. There are things that you're waiting for that you want, but that you feel like are too unspiritual or seem too like sinful or out of context for God to care about. And so I would love for us to talk about hope a little bit. And yeah, this kind of concept of darkness, because I think that, again, They're not opposites. Hope and darkness are not opposites. But I think that that's how a lot of Christian communities frame them, especially with that kind of John 1 expression of, it is. It's like, the world is hopeless, therefore the light has come. And that's great. Like, it's a great metaphor, but I'm curious what you think.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It sounds like your experience is more shame-based, just trying to eradicate all the bad things. Get rid of that darkness.
Yes, and to work really hard to define dark.
Yeah.
Everything was about, like, what is bad? What is evil? What is, since you couldn't even, like, look at the general things that were happening in you, how do we define all the bad things and avoid them instead of going, like, maybe there's, like, hopelessness and chaos in your life right now that God wants to bring hope to? It was, like, so rarely that. It was more just sin management. So you're right.
Yeah. Yes. Sin management is real. And when you grow up with it, you will carry it with you. Yeah, man, there's a lot to unpack there. I think you're right. I think traditionally there's that understanding of hope versus the darkness. I don't know. I was trying to think of how to define it when you were talking about it. And it's, to me, hope is like this, it's this expectation. It's clinging to this expectation of your own understanding of goodness, like your best understanding of goodness, and trusting that somehow that will come to fruition. I can hope to win the lottery, but there's not, like, that's very unlikely. And if I never buy a lottery ticket, it'll never occur. Can you talk a little bit more about your own experience of viewing the opposite of hope as darkness?
Well, I think that there is a way that people like Isaiah or Jeremiah describe the people as being in darkness, that either the situation that they're in is darkness, or that they themselves are full of darkness. But actually, I think that a lot of the darkness metaphors come to fruition far more in the New Testament than they do in the Old, but we act like it's a very old and ancient Hebrew text concept. Because I think there's things like in 1 Peter where it's talking about, like, well, if the darkness, like, well, Jesus talks about, like, if the darkness in you is light, like, how great is that darkness? And Peter talks about, like, what it means to be people of light who are foregoing darkness. And those become abstracted to be about sin. And so, like, to be people of hope in all of these kind of New Testament things, or like a community of hope, which is really what a lot of the early church is trying to engage with, is to be people who hope in God to form this, like, radical community of Jesus followers and literally save their lives. But I think in our context, we superimpose that idea onto just hoping that we can be better, or hoping that we won't go to hell when we die. And so the opposite gets set up, or like that juxtaposition gets set up, because our major hope, the thing that we most hope for, is something after we're dead. And the way that we get that thing is by foregoing darkness, by foregoing sin, by foregoing evil. And so while they are not opposite things, that's what our, this kind of single verse truncation of what is happening in scripture does, is it says, hope is actually about a thing way out there, far away, that you get by, like the lottery ticket that you buy in that metaphor is sin management. And so you get out of your own darkness by managing your sin, and then you have a hope for something later. So it's like, you never actually hope. You have a hope as, like, a noun that's far away, and hope is not a verb, like an active thing that you do, because we'd rather make it about something else later.
Yeah. So hope is, like, just fear-based in that context.
Yes.
So it's not actually very hopeful at all. Yeah, because I think when I was reviewing the whole story of Advent, I was reading about Zechariah. And I wrote down in Luke 1, towards the end of it, it's Zechariah's song, or that's however it's labeled, which, you know, they didn't actually label it. But yeah, he and his wife have John, who later becomes John the Baptist. And it was just really interesting to read through this song or this prophecy that was kind of spoken over John the Baptist. And I'm just going to read it really quick, just a little excerpt. It says, "And you, my child, will be called the prophet of the Most High. For you will go on before the Lord to prepare the way for him, to give his people the knowledge of salvation through the forgiveness of their sins, because of the tender mercy of our God, by which the rising sun will come to us from heaven. And in this part, to shine on those living in darkness and in the shadow of death. But then it says, to guide our feet into the path of peace," which we don't really talk about that much. Like, we briefly talk about it at Christmas about, like, peace on earth, goodwill to men. But we just talk about it on Christmas. And that day is, like, that's the holy day. But then we can resume all conflict after, which seems like such a flat, shallow hope. I think that we are called to live into this path of peace. And it's not about just this sin management, like trying to not do something, trying to do something the right way, the best way, but literally about living this like shalom together, this wholeness, this completeness where we are on the path of peace together, living fully into that hope.
I think there are ways that it can feel very abstract to consider things that aren't opposites to be on poles, but I think that a lot of Christianity does that. And I think it makes us believe, or sets us up in some way to believe, that we're only allowed to hope if we're good enough. Like, that hope is for the faithful, hope is for the pure, hope is for these people who trust in God in a certain way that allows us to have hope, that like gives us permission to have hope. And I think that for me, as I consider injustice in the world right now, that's not what I see God inviting people to do in hope. Like, when I think about like the kind of Christian approach of like, yeah, of sin management, or of thinking that you need to deserve to be able to hope in God, I can't imagine that being translated into any social movement that I see right now. Like, there's no way. Because hope isn't for those who already have everything they need. Hope is for those who need. Hope is for those who experience marginalization and need to know that there is something better, that there could be more, that we can, there's something to fight for, there's something to move toward. And I think when we lose that conception of hope that is for the most marginalized, that in the Advent story comes to the most marginalized, I think we miss out on the very character of God that seems to, for lack of better terms, give a shit about rulers and powers if there's a choice between the powerful and the oppressed. We always find Jesus and God throughout all of scripture on the side of the marginalized and oppressed to give them hope that often that can look like the overturning of their enemies. It can look like the building of their families. It can look like finding a place to live and to live their whole lives out. It can look like having illness dealt with in them. It can look like having their minds freed. It can look like all kinds of things. But it doesn't look much like, oh yeah, just this like later thing that's abstracted in the future. And so I've just felt very concerned about how we can actually do an Advent that focuses on hope in any way if we don't first say, like, actually for many American folks with a lot of privilege, hope really isn't exactly for us all the time. Like, and the kinds of hope that scripture is focusing on, hope for a marginalized people under occupation, who are experiencing violence regularly, whose land has been taken from them, who are tenant farmers on the land they once owned, who are subject to corrupt governments. Like, their hope looks really different than just like, Jesus is here, so everything's good now. And I think it twists our view of who Jesus is and what Jesus is about, that I think for me at least makes it really hard to engage with Advent most of the time, because it makes me feel like things need to be like fluffy and spiritual, or I need to be in the right place, instead of going like, God, things aren't the way I want them to be. Can they be different? And to hold that question and let that question draw me to hope more than just like reciting memory verses about how good God is or how I should hope.
Yeah, you're totally right. It's hard for us to even relate to the context in which the culture he was born into, the people he was born into, like, especially coming from, you know, various places of privilege. Your comment about maybe hope isn't for us, like, it is for us, but figuring out what that means. And I think that moves you towards justice, not on an individual basis necessarily, but on a more communal basis of wanting to seek justice, wanting to see the wholeness of goodness enacted in the world. And that is kind of what we hope for, is yeah, that pursuit of peace together.
Do you have ways that you've experienced that in your own life that you can think of?
Well, okay. So also what you were hitting on was resonating with me about, you know, not feeling like you are holy enough or spiritual enough or whatever it is, you're not enough to hope for something or to ask God for something. I think for someone who comes from being pretty deeply entrenched in Christianity from the get-go, that's something that I'm constantly dealing with, is just not feeling like, you know, you're good enough for God, and having to remind yourself like, okay, I don't need to. Anyway, all of that to say, my biggest hope right now in my current life circumstances, which is very individual based, but I think then has communal implications, is just for really the reconciliation of relationships with people who disagree with me regarding sexuality and faith, and wanting to see those relationships restored, but also, oh man, wanting the strength and the grace to be able to engage in those things, in those conversations, because they suck really hard, and I don't want to have them. And I like, and also boundaries are good and healthy. And so there are plenty of times that you say, I can't have those conversations, but you know, my hope is that individually that those relationships would be able to be reconciled, but then communally that we would just, as a church, as a people, be inclusive, be welcoming, mm-hmm. you know, have our arms open to those on the fringes, those who are marginalized. And, you know, one aspect of that is sexuality, but there's so many other mm-hmm. regards in which we need to be inclusive. I think that that is mm-hmm. pursuing peace.
Yeah. And that's hard. Like I think I wanted to ask you that question because I think that, again, hope can be so, hope for you as a queer person with non-affirming friends and family means something really different for you as you like live your life and have a baby and figure out what does family look like and mean for you. And that's not some abstracted thing. That's like your daily life that hope steps in it. And it's not a pleasant thing. Like hope is not a thing that is like so great and nice. It having hope is great. And knowing that we can have a hope and that God cares enough to allow us to dream in that way is like really beautiful. But hope at the end of the day, I say this in one of the devotional we do, is like a pain in the ass because it is setting ourselves up for an unknown amount of, for an unknown length of time, pain that we don't know if will ever come to pass, but that in believing something, that something could be better, we buy that lottery ticket. We do something toward the thing instead of just assuming good, but never doing anything, or never doing anything because we don't assume good. And so I think there's like this hope that we hold that is the more abstract thing, but that always has tangible implications. And I just recognize that for you, the implications of that are really different than the implications for me, and that's deeply painful. And so for a lot, and I know we have a lot of folks who are coming out, who have very recently come out or figuring out what it means to have, yeah, their families and friends know things about them that they didn't know before and learn about them and meet their partners or their spouses or their kids for the first time, and that hope looks really different. And so I guess I'm wondering if you have any words for folks who are on that journey right now, because I think it's really significant for folks to hear the voices of people whose experiences they share. And so, yeah, do you have any advice for people who are attempting to hold on to hope in the midst of the current experiences that they're having?
Well, first and foremost, I would tell them that they are loved. Mm-hmm. I think that you hear from a lot of different sources, including yourself, that you're not loved for whatever reason, but you are deeply, deeply loved. As I mentioned earlier, boundaries are good and important and really, really hard. And I think you have to have grace with yourself that you're not going to do it perfectly. You're going to end up causing some hurt, and people are going to definitely hurt you. But to be gracious in that, I think when you have experiences of being kicked out of communities or losing work or, you know, losing relationships because you've come out, it's going to impact you. So it's either going to make you someone who's much more bitter and hardened, or I think it can have the result of somehow miraculously you could become a more gracious, patient, loving person, still with remnants of that bitterness in terms of just understanding that the world is a really hard place. And sorry, Henry's barking. that it is not easy to exist as a queer person of faith. Absolutely still cling to your faith if that is what is important to you. You don't have to lose that because you're queer. Should a lot of people feel like they have to, but there are some really awesome, loving spaces available. There are lots of resources. I mentioned that book earlier, but I would also recommend people listen to Queerology. Mm-hmm. That is an awesome podcast. Have you listened to that?
I have.
They're really lovely.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I think that especially as I consider the specific marginalization of queer folks and the isolation that things like holidays already bring for folks who have experiences with their families that are violent, that are disorienting, that are disappointing, that are really life-taking in a lot of ways, that this season leading up to Christmas during COVID might exacerbate that in some ways. And so I just appreciate your words of hope and of encouragement to people that things can be different, because I've watched you go through that journey and I see your life being really different and you pursuing joy and life in ways that are really, really beautiful. And like, you and your wife, Rachel, are amazing people. I'm so excited for you and your family and all of your animals. You have like a little zoo over there.
For real. Oh my gosh.
But I just love that as you've embraced what it means to be fully yourself and done that so courageously and through so much like pain and tension, to use like the lightest word, that the hope that you've held both in God and in your family and your community, and that there is a different way, I've seen be so good for people around you. And so I just want to honor that and to recognize that your story can be other people's stories too. And that it is a holding of both pain and life and growth and self-acceptance all at the same time.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Well, Kylie, is there anything you want to plug? Anything that you want people to know about that you're up to? I know you're probably focusing a lot on having a child, but...
Having a child. I would love, if anyone wanted to write a musical about a coming out experience, I have so many songs for that. So if there are any playwrights who are wanting to write a musical, I'm your girl. You can find me on Spotify.
That's amazing. I hope we find a playwright to write stories about a musical about coming out.
I know they're out there. I know they are.
Well, I would love to see that. So shout out to y'all. If you've got some skills, find Kylie on Spotify. She's a really, really excellent musician and plays some soothing music. So yeah, Kylie, I just appreciate your time and thank you so much for being on today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Well, y'all, that wraps our first episode of our Advent series talking about hope and hearing from some people whose experiences in their lived bodies right now tell us something about God. And so I encourage you to listen to more stories of folks who we may not normally see centered in our Christmas narrative. If you're still interested in picking up the devotional, you can find that at reclaimingmytheology.com/shop. And you can find other information on the website about what we do, who we are, and how you can be involved with it. So as always, like I already said once in this little blurb, gosh, I need to take my own advice and do better together.